Okay, hi everyone. Welcome to our live Q&A with the directors of Murder Among the Mormons, Tyler Meesom and Jared Hess. I'm so excited they made time in their day to hang out with Mormons. And I'm really excited for this Q&A because you guys have been doing press all over the world. Little Mormons in the big, big world out there doing, you know, big press junkets. And now you're talking to Mormons. We're going to have the questions that Mormons want to know. We have a watch party for those who haven't been involved. We have an exclusive watch party with about 500 people, which I feel like is award size. Does that constitute
an award? That's huge. I cracked open a Fresca in honor of this occasion.
I have my official drink of Salt Lake City.
Oh my
Tyler,
gosh.
Don't let us down. What have you got?
Wigging out.
Perfect. So in our group, we have everything from faithful Mormons, Latter-day Saints, you know, some people right off the mission, fresh off the mission, to ex-Mormons and Mormon fundamentalists and non-believers. And we've got a few Gentiles in the group as well. So I'm excited to talk to you guys about the questions that they've come up with. But first, I want to give a few announcements. First of all, thank you to Grace Poole from Sunstone for organizing this event. I think it's been so great. And just a reminder that we've been doing this as sort of a fundraiser for Sunstone. So it's a free event, but if you want to support Sunstone, we run completely on donations. So anything you give will be blessings in heaven. So let's get into it. I want to introduce Tyler and Jared. I don't think you really need introductions, but let's do that for anyone who hasn't been binge watching Netflix in the last few days. You guys, this is so big. You've taken the Mormon story on a huge level, so I'm really excited. So Ty Meesom, you are a filmmaker who has made, I don't know, Sons of Perdition, I Want My MTV, An Honest Liar. That's probably my favorite one with the amazing Randy. It's so good. So if you guys haven't seen An Honest Liar, it's brilliant storytelling. And Jared, you've made a few films yourself too. The iconic favorite Napoleon Dynamite and Nacho Libre. And there's a new one too.
The most recent one was Masterminds that came out a couple of years ago. Is that the one you're referring to?
No, I saw you. Aren't you producing something for television right now? Or you did a history thing?
I did. You know, I worked on The Righteous Gemstones with my buddy Danny McBride on HBO. I don't know if that's...
Yeah, that okay.
A lot of idiotic things I'm doing. So, yeah.
No, that's so great. It's so fun to talk to you guys, especially because you have a Mormon background. And I think that's one of the things that we're going to get into talking about. People have been asking you guys all sorts of questions about your Mormonism. Before we get into the questions that people have asked, why don't we talk about this a little bit? Why this film? Why did you guys decide to take this story on?
Oh my gosh. Well, I mean, first of all, it's a story about Mormon nerds. So I feel like I'm really in my lane with nerd stories. But yeah, I mean, gosh, for me, look, I've been a big fan of true crime stuff since as long as I can remember. I mean, documentaries, I find myself watching them more than any other genre. I've always wanted to make something in the nonfiction space. And, you know, I would say about 15 years ago when I really dove into the Mark Hoffman story and started reading all the books about it and obsessing over it. I'm also close friends with Kurt Bench of Benchmark Books, who's helping out tonight. And, you know, I've gone to lunch with him over the years and would hear all of his absolutely insane Mark Hoffman stories. And it's just, you know, it's just been this passion project for such a long time for me, and you know, the same goes for Tyler.
Yeah, I mean, I knew about it. I knew about it growing up. For the most part, I grew up in Pleasant Grove, went to Pleasant Grove High School, and I kind of knew about it. But when I was in high school, it happened in 1985. I was 14 years old, so I didn't really pay much mind to it. But then later in life, Doug Fabrizio, actually, who does Radio West, he gave me a book. And he said, Tyler, you should do a documentary about this. So I read it and I thought, holy shit, of course I'm going to make, can I swear? I can swear, right? I can swear. I said, I got to make this movie. And I was scared to death to make it because it was such a big, big story. But I said, I'm going to try it. I'm going to go for it. And I had a lull in my schedule between my MTV film. Like literally it took months for the contract to be signed. So I just said, I'm going to go do this. So I just went out and I shot Brent Ashworth in an interview. And then I shot a couple other people just purely out of pocket. And then I caught wind that Jared had been nerding out about this story for a long time. So I called him up. We went and had sushi. And by the end of the meal, we said, let's do this together. So that was 2017. And here we are in 2021.
Well, I know. And I think it's such an important film for Mormons of all stripes, because it's not just a story of true crime and murder. It's a story of our history, you know, and that's why the Sunstone crowd, I think, is particularly interested in it, because like you said, Jared, Kurt Bench, he's a longtime Sunstoner. It's the story of people that we all know. And so I think this audience is a little different than maybe the rest of the audience out there, because the Mormon world is small and we're all connected. Do you guys have any personal connections to the story outside of making the film?
My cousin is in the film, Ron Meesum. And he went to college with Mark. He was Mark's good friend in college. And he told some great stories about Mark. I wish we could go into it more. We had a really difficult time finding anyone from Mark's youth. And he was one who knew him and knew him pretty well. In fact, Mark gave the closing prayer at his mission farewell, and they went to the same mission. So, you know, he'd always tell these stories, and you know, when we get together at family reunions, and he'd tell these stories about Mark Hoffman and the mythology of him. So that's my only real personal connection outside of having worked on it for the last 4 years.
Yeah, my only connection is direct connection is listening to Kurt Bench talk about Mark's hot tub parties that Kurt says he never went to. But one of the things Hoffman splurged on was a sweet hot tub, because that's how you roll in Mill Creek. But again,
is this a real thing? The hot tub thing
is real. Oh, yeah. Mark, you know, one of his, you know, extravagant purchases was a hot tub in addition to Walmart too.
That's episode 4. That's coming out in a couple of weeks. Hot tub Hoffman.
That's amazing. That's very on brand for how I picture Mark Hoffman in my head. No, it's not. But that's, we'll get into talking about that too, because you talk about the nerd in Mark Hoffman, but you also show how he wanted to be really cool. And maybe the hot tub is part of his forging his coolness. I don't know. Okay, well, I bet I could find connections. You just got to give me your group sheet and I bet I can find connections in your genealogy to this whole thing. How about, let's just get into some of the stuff. Let's talk about the title first, because I remember when Tyler told me the title, I was like, oh, Murder Among the Mormons is just so obvious. But why don't you tell me why the title, how that happened?
Our working title for forever was The Salamander, right, Tyler?
And then, yeah, I mean, originally it was Forger, which, spoiler alert, is gives it away.
Yeah.
Salamander.
And then, yeah, I mean, and kind of the logic behind it, it's like Netflix, they have so many menu items, right? And they have found that, especially in their true crime space, if you just call it what it is, like that's how it kind of cuts through the noise. It's like, if you go to a restaurant, it's like, well, I'd like to order the sunrise blossom. And you're like, but what is it? And it's like, it's a chicken dumpling. It's like Netflix is like, just call it a chicken dumpling. And I think for a while we were toying with like The Salamander Murders, but they were like, look, this sounds like a movie about killing lizards. It's going to confuse people. And then, you know, obviously we all heard the little soundbite that's at the beginning of the film, Murder Among the Mormons. And it was like, boom, that's it. I mean, it's just calling it what it is.
And Murder Among the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints didn't have the the same zing to it, I would think.
Well, and that's the tension I think we're going to explore today, because like I said, this particular Q&A is from a Mormon audience, and I really think it would be fascinating to have, you know, non-Mormons who love the film watch this to see what we care about. I guarantee the stuff we care about are not the things anyone else is caring about. And the title is one of those, because some of us are so connected to this story or know so much about it. You guys have seen a lot of strong opinions. Are the strongest opinions coming from Mormons or non-Mormons, or is it just sort of all over the place?
I would say all over the place. I mean, I think the people most excited about the film, weirdly enough, is the rest of the world, because they don't know anything about this story. I mean, it was such like an isolated regional thing that happened. And most people don't know jack squat about Mormonism, and they don't care about Mormonism, but they're interested in it when it's presented to them, because it's, you know, it's always got like a weird culture to it, and kind of the beliefs are shrouded in a bit of mystery. And so people come into this film and they're just kind of like, you know, I mean, they're shocked at what they learned, and they're even more shocked that they never knew about the story. So it, I mean, it played to our advantage, I think, when we were structuring it, that we could really hold on to some secrets for a long time and not tip our hand that Hoffman was the bad guy. And there are people, you know, that have watched it that are like, literally until the end of episode two, they had no idea it was Hoffman. We're like, what? We're also close to it, right? In the community that, anyway, pretty funny.
No, I love that. And I was telling Tyler about this, because Tyler has asked me to help him on another project. So I've had the opportunity to work with Tyler a little bit and learn from his storytelling. And I'm noticing that, Tyler, you like to leave the reveal at the very end. And so I had to, when I was framing this, I was going to be like, Hoffman, the murderer. And then I thought, no, Tyler doesn't want the spoiler. So we would say, you know, this crime, but it's kind of interesting, because those of us who know, it's very obvious, the story. And we still enjoyed it even without the reveal, but I've heard a lot of people, the reveal has been important. Why did you choose to tell the story that way?
It was difficult because two things is, yes, I think the most important thing in telling a story is how long can you keep a secret, regardless of what it is, you know? I made a film, An Honest Liar, is about magicians, and they're so good at just keeping that suspense for so long until they absolutely have to tell you. And so we always wanted to keep a secret with this as much as we could. However, one of the difficulties is with this story is that, frankly, the first 30 minutes could be boring. It's dudes talking about books and a bunch of white old men, and, you know, a little bit about the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So it's kind of boring in some ways, and especially in today's world, you know, like, people have so many options to watch that we had to figure out a way to really hook them early. And of course, so we started with the bombs, you know, we started with Shannon Flynn, which after that line, you're in for the most part. So we put the bombs to kind of tease them that once you get past all this book stuff, which for this audience, they love, but most people don't. Once you get past all this stuff, there's going to be some action, if you will. So we always tried to like set it up, reveal a little bit, and then pull back and give a little bit and then come back. And it was difficult. The most difficult thing when you're making a film is not what you put in, but what you take out. And I can't tell you, I mean, the biggest debates we've seen in the Twitterverse and Reddit and reviews is they should have put more in. They should have taken less out. It should have been 2 hours. It should have been 6 hours. It should have been... It's exhausting what people wanted in the film or what they didn't want or what was too much. It's honestly, that's the biggest reviews we've gotten. That's too much or not enough, or we didn't include this, or we didn't include that, or we should have put Oaks in, or we shouldn't have put this in. Honestly, we just tried to tell a good story. And we knew that Netflix is 191 countries in the world. You know, 500 million people subscribe to Netflix. And how can we most appeal to them and tell a great story? So yeah, we may have left your favorite part out, or we may have left a document or two out, but by and large, we just tried to streamline the best story we could.
Yeah. And at the end of the day too, it's like, you know, the stuff that we left out, you know, is incredibly boring to the rest of the world, surprisingly, right? Like, you know, we could have done a deep dive in the Joseph Smith III blessing and how Hoffman was trying to sell that to the RLDS church and you know, but it was such a detour. So we really had to take some big creative swings and go, okay, what are the most relevant documents to the story? What were the ones that caused the most disruption? And especially how they related to Mark and how they were affecting his life at that time. So yeah, it was, I mean, look, there were so many things. And, you know, we interviewed over 30 people and did, you know, I think only 12 or 15 ended up on screen. I'm super bummed that we didn't get my boy D. Michael Quinn in there. I mean, because I could listen to that guy talk for hours, and we did on the day and got some sweet nuggets, but unfortunately those nuggets aren't in the film. We just had too many dudes.
Did I hear this right, that it was supposed to be longer? The set, like, you wrote it maybe making it longer, and
we
then you
pitched
had to
it initially out. Yeah, we pitched it initially as a 6-part series, because I mean, look, it's like you've got Hoffman who's committing 6 years worth of crimes. It wasn't just like a couple of big ones, but every transaction over the course of 6 years, when, you know, it was a forgery, there's like an incredible amount of stories behind whatever transaction he was making. And so you know, I mean, it absolutely warrants like 6 episodes or 10 or 12 or whatever. But ultimately, you know, Netflix, I think they realized by, you know, they've had some series that are just way too long and everybody complains, man, they were really like stretching it out and it should have been shorter. And so I think their format now is 3 or 4 episodes for their doc series. And mostly 3 now. But I mean, it was a really good exercise and it really affected the pacing too. It really, I think we had to figure out, you know, again, where the little cliffhangers were going to be. They want all their stuff to be binge worthy. And so we spent a lot of time, again, holding secrets and trying to figure out, you know, what was really going to excite people about watching the next one.
Yeah, and so, it gave us, like, we had this opportunity, especially with episode 3, and everyone, I assume, has seen the film, so I don't have to spoil it, but it kind of gave us the opportunity in episode 3 to really, you know, for one, we focused on the where and the what, and then we focused on 2 in the investigation. And then with 3, we really investigated or, you know, focused on the why and the how in some ways. And that was really nice to be able to hold that back, to be able to not early or throughout the whole piece try to, you know, say how Mark forged a document or why he's crazy or why this stuff happened, but really to put the emotion and the regret and the pain that was caused all in one episode at the end. And that was something that I think 3 episodes was great. Jared and I haven't not done any of those, and I've done documentaries, but not series. So it was a learning experience, but it was a blast doing it, of course.
Yeah, I think it really lent itself to this format, because people have been binge watching it. I've been seeing that. You know, I'm one of the people that binge watched it when I saw it. I want to talk about your guys.
You what? Can tell people. You can tell.
Can
people.
I? You sure? I don't want to ruin it. I got to see it early. I was lucky, which was so cool. And I was geeking out about it early. And it was hard to keep my mouth shut about it because I have a lot of opinions. And so it's been fun to, but I did watch it again. I watched it with our group and I got some new things out of it too, which was kind of exciting. I want to talk about your Mormonism, but let's save that for the end because we're kind of into the discussion now. So I'm just going to go with some of the questions. Mike Nielsen, he was asking about the 6-hour to 3-hour thing, but he wants to know what you were sad that you had to take out. What do you wish you could have kept in that was something that maybe you were really attached to?
Hot tub parties, Hoffman hot tub parties.
The hot tub parties. For me, you know, one of the incredible stories that blows my mind is the story of Gerald and Sandra Tanner. And, you know, for people that don't know who the Tanners are, they're kind of like the OG critical Mormon team, you know, that has kind of been a thorn in the church's side for a long time. They've got an amazing, they're Christians. I think they're it's called Lighthouse Ministries, I think. But they, you know, they've got like a sweet collection of what a lot of Mormons would call anti-material, but it's just history, basically. And when the Salamander letter came out, and you've got like Dean Jesse down at BYU and all these people authenticating it, all these different authorities and specialists saying, yeah, the Salamander letter is legit, it checks out, the content does, the handwriting, the paper, the ink. Gerald Tanner, who probably should have loved that thing be real, because it, you know, really kind of promoted their whole cause and what they believe about the church, he was like, it's too pat. I think it's a forgery, and even it could be a forgery at the time, but I think the content of it is too kind of weak sauce and obvious. And he's like, I don't think it's real. And that blows my mind. But again, it was one of those stories. To the rest of the world, they just don't care about that. It's a big deal to, I think, a handful of like Mormons and post-Mormons, but nobody else really cares. It was one that our two editors, Matt Prekop and Greg O'Toole, who were not LDS, have no connection to Mormonism or Utah for that matter. They were just like, guys, this is super freaking boring. Nobody gives a crap about it. So that happened all the time, and that's the reality of some of those things. But yeah, anyway, that for me, that was a big one. I kept trying to find a way to get it in, and it was just like slowing down the pace. It was like a detour from, you know, the momentum of the narrative that we created. So
anyway. Yeah, and Gerald Tanner thought the Salamander letter was a forgery because it was too close to E.B. Howe's book, Mormonism Unveiled, and he felt right, that it right. was a forgery. He didn't. The funny thing is nobody ever said Mark was a forger. No, never did I ever hear he was a forger. There were a couple times where Brent Ashworth called out something that Mark had brought into him. And they were these Butch Cassidy photographs that he'd forged and he'd written on the back of that apparently were like wanted photographs. And Brent Ashworth said, those are forgeries. And Mark was like, well, I must have bought them from someone who thought they were real. I'll just take them back. So that's the only time anyone ever called Mark out for a forgery, as far as I know. But Gerald Tanner was the one who said it was a forgery. The Salamander letter was a forgery, but he didn't say it was from Mark. He said it was probably forged back in the 1800s. So that's a great story. Mine, I wish we could have gone into, and this is one scene we tried to do, is the Emily Dickinson poem. Which is portrayed really great in the book Poet and the Murderer. And it's about in 1997, an Emily Dickinson poem had resurfaced, a lost Emily Dickinson poem, and this small town in Amherst, Massachusetts, where the Emily Dickinson Museum is, they wanted to buy it. So they pooled all their money together. They got money from the community and they purchased this document. And the owner of it was so pleased and so happy and so amazed because he loved Emily Dickinson. And we interviewed him and he told this great story about pulling it out of its sleeve and reading it, knowing that Emily Dickinson's hand had touched this, that she had written this poem. And then he threw this big, huge party. Like they had this big party planned where they were going to reveal it. And literally the day before, Brent Ashworth called him up and said, you know, Mark Hoffman offered me that poem about 10 years ago. Or it was at the time, I was thinking 15 years ago. And this guy went down the research hole to try and figure out if it was a Hoffman, and ultimately it was. And that was a story we tried like hell to tell. And just, again, it was like, at the end of it, we just couldn't keep going further. But that's one thing I wish we could have told.
I just want to know what he was doing at the hot tub parties. I mean, he seemed like such a nerdy, boring guy. And I know document dealers, there was no way, no offense, Kurt Bench and all your friends, there's no way that would have been a wild party. Everyone would have been talking about, you know, book dust jackets and things like that.
Apparently there was an incident where Mark placed his hand accidentally, or no, someone's wife accidentally placed
played footsie with Hoffman thinking it was her husband, and right. Mark never said anything under the hot tub bubbles.
And then
we're not gonna say who it was.
That's your sequel, Under Hot Tub Bubbles, all the things you didn't get to include.
That's right.
Okay, so I said I was going to wait till the end to talk about Mormonism, but as I'm looking at these questions from people, I think that it needs to come up. Let's talk about your connections to Mormonism, because you both have a background in it. And in our community, it's interesting, you know, there's some ex-Mormons who think you didn't go far enough, that maybe you're protecting the church, and some faithful who think that you're attacking the church. Let's talk about your background and how that plays into this, and then we can get into other questions.
I'll go first. Great. I guess I was raised in I was raised in Pleasant Grove, Utah. Big Mormon family, five sisters, one brother. Went on a mission to Missouri Independence, and then I came home and started to realize and recognize that it wasn't for me. I was kind of tired of feeling guilty for having bad thoughts all the time. I won't go into too much of what my bad thoughts were.
Hot tub parties, that we already know.
With Kurt Bench.
Kurt's going to kill us because he had nothing to do with the hot tub parties.
No, I was invited all the time, but I never went to the hot tub parties. Anyway,
Shannon Flynn went though. Sorry, keep going.
Shannon went, and I think Brent Metcalf went. Apparently, there was an incident where Shannon and Mark jumped out of the hot tub and did snow angels and jumped back in the hot tub.
That's not real. Is that real?
That's about the crazy.
Somebody should try and make a GIF of that and put it out online.
Oh my gosh, Shannon!
Just kidding.
Nonetheless, I just felt it wasn't for me. And then I started to do research and history, and I just couldn't be in it any longer. And then I don't remember what year it was, 2000, was it 2004, six, when the church came out against Prop 3 here in Utah. And I said, I'm out. So I wrote, took my name off the records. And I don't subscribe to their beliefs, especially in their history. To be quite frank, I've done a lot of research in polygamy. My first film was about polygamy, and I can't justify polygamy. I'll never be able to justify that Joseph Smith and Brigham Young had multiple wives. I don't think that's necessary and never will. So that's me. However, what I will say is it didn't affect the making of this film. The fact of the matter is this is a great story. And if I have an axe to grind, I left it at the door. You know, I know there's a large group of people, and they think they're large, and they think it's important to, you know, to show the darkness and the ugliness of Mormonism. The fact of the matter is they want to see that. The majority of the world just doesn't want to see that movie. And I get requests all the time, you should make a movie exposing Mormonism, you should make, and frankly, it just doesn't appeal to me. I want to make a story that most people love and has a nice beginning, middle, and an end. And I think we did that. So that's my story.
Do you have any affection for it or a heritage connection?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look, it's my DNA. It's my family. Even polygamy is in my genes, you know, my Dockers, whatever I'm wearing that day, I guess. it's my past. My family's still in it. My mother is still in it. My father passed. So it's a big part of me. And the fact of the matter is it's a part of who I am. You know, when you're raised LDS, you're taught to evangelize. You're taught to believe and to preach in what you believe. And if you believe something, you send it out to the world wholeheartedly and passionately. And have I taken that into my documentary making? You bet I have. You know, do I regret a Mormon mission? Absolutely not, because I could, 19-year-old kid, sell Mormonism to people in Kansas. I can sell documentaries to Netflix. So that is who I am. It's my culture. It's my upbringing. It's my family. I just don't want to go to church anymore.
I might have heard called to serve tones playing in the background as you told me that. Very beautiful. Thank you.
You can dub that in later.
How about you, Jared?
Yeah, you know, just kind of going back to what Tyler was talking about a second ago. I mean, it's like we didn't make this film for the handful of people that have read all the books on Hoffman, and we didn't make this for people that wanted like an expose in the church. That's just not what the story was. And I mean, you know, it would be like, gosh, I'm going to set out to prove that Hogwarts is a fake institution full of corruption and sorcery. I mean, it's like the whole world already believes that that's fiction, and the whole world outside of Mormonism already doesn't believe Mormonism. So, I mean, it just doesn't seem like the best use of time, right? When people already believe it to be fiction. So anyway, it's and that's not what this story was. There were so many other relevant themes and all that kind of stuff. But gosh, as far as my Mormonism goes, man, you know, I come from full blown pioneer stock on both sides, raised in the church. You know, my dad's where I'm the oldest of six boys. So I've got five younger brothers. I was, you know, moved around a bunch growing up. My dad was the bishop of the Hyde Park ward in the mid 1980s in London, England. So I lived there for a bit, and that was just an amazing time. He passed away shortly thereafter. He was 33, died of cancer. And so my mom had, you know, like five young boys. We moved from Texas to Utah, and then my mom, you know, remarried my stepdad, who, you know, raised all of us and just died a couple months ago, actually. Just an amazing man, but totally raised in the church. Went on a mission, went to, you know, I went to BYU, went to film school at BYU. But I went to Venezuela, Caracas on my mission. I was there for a year, got hernias, and they were like, Hesh, you're not going to go under the knife down here. You got to go home. So came home, got operated on, and then I was reassigned to Chicago Spanish speaking. Just absolutely love my mission. It's funny, when I was on my mission, this dude on the street, and I've told this story a ton, but this guy was like, yo, church people, come here, I wanna talk to you. It was this old Italian guy. And he's like, why are you guys both called elders? What's this name about? I'm like, well, it's a title we carry for 2 years as missionaries of the Lord. And he was like, oh, that's great. I was like, what's your name, sir? And he was like, my name is Napoleon Dynamite. And I was like, holy crap. And I pulled out my little blue planner card, and I was like, title of first movie must be Napoleon Dynamite. Anyway, so when the film came out, my mission companion who was with me at the time, he was like, I'm glad you did that, Hess. I'm glad you did that. Anyway, so come
that's
home.
Like up there with Three Nephites, Lord. That's some serious Mormon storytelling. Well done on that.
Well, anyway, so that's the mish. But go to BYU, go to film school, meet my amazing wife, Jerusha. We get married. We write Napoleon. And then one summer, go up to Preston, make the film. She was pregnant with her first son, Elliot, when we were shooting. And anyway, whatever. It got into Sundance, and it kind of launched everybody's careers that worked on the film. And we write screenplays together. Jerusha and I, we've collaborated on everything that we've done. She's way smarter and more amazing than I'll ever be. And we have two biological kids and two adopted. We have a son named George that we adopted from Bulgaria. He has Down syndrome and autism. He's nonverbal and he's amazing and a handful. And our daughter Birdie is African-American. We adopted her here in the States. And so we've got this kind of awesome blended family in many aspects. And you know, I think the short of it for me, as it relates to my Mormonism, I you know, just got obsessed with church history, Mormon history. As a whole, I find it so fascinating. I find all the weird fringe stories, all the little fringe groups that broke off to be completely hilarious and mind-blowing. And I wish I could just make movies about fringe groups and cult leaders. I think that they're full of comedy and tragedy and all those things.
And lots, you know, of manifestos, lots of manifestos.
But I love it. And literally I've given Kurt Bench thousands of dollars over the years as I've made, you know, my library, but it's all the dorky stuff, I guess. But at the end of the day, for me, I'm not a religious literalist. I don't believe in the literal stories of anything, really. So at the end of the day, it's like, as it relates to Mormonism, I consider myself Mormon, even though I don't believe any of the hurtful stuff or the goofy stuff. So that kind of sums me up. And you know, I go to church. I have major affection for it. I think, you know, our family situation and raising a special needs child, it doesn't work for us. And there are just so many other, you know, look, it's like any institution or religious tradition has good ideas and bad ideas, and the bad ideas that cause unnecessary suffering and pain. It's just like, I mean, name them all in Mormonism, right? Like we know them all here. We don't have to talk about them. But it's like Mormonism for me has always been the vehicle for good, that introduced me to the good ideas of just essentially loving your neighbor. And to me, that's all that matters. And everything else doesn't really matter. I feel like, you know, you're wasting your time worrying and trying to be perfect. So,
well, I appreciate you guys answering that. I know, you know, you've been asked that a lot, and I know it's kind of a fraught political thing in our space, but Sunstone, there's more than one way to Mormon, and we just want people to engage Mormonism at a level that they're comfortable with, regardless of their beliefs. So thank you. Alan Lund asked, did the directors have any pushback from the church not wanting them to produce this?
No. Not at all. In fact, you know, it's funny. And this is an interesting connection. So I'd never met Richard Turley before he started this. We're related through polygamy, through my grandma, weirdly. And I can't even, it's like he and my grandma are like third cousins or something. My grandma was a Turley, just an amazing woman, about to turn 90, lives up in Brigham City. But I've read, you know, all of Turley's books, all of his history stuff. You know, he was director of public affairs when we, you know, started, I guess, early pre-production, and was up until, I think, March 2020 when he retired, I think, Tyler, something like that. But he, again, was such an incredible authority and resource. He knows kind of the church perspective, and was instrumental in helping us get all the archival footage we needed from KSL. Because KSL essentially has like an internal policy, and they just told us, they said, look, anytime anybody comes after us wanting archival footage about Ted Bundy, the Lafferty brothers, or Mark Hoffman, it's an automatic no. And I think that they just don't want the negative attention, obviously, that those killers have to Mormonism. And of course, like it makes perfect sense. So we, you know, I think, you know, Rick being open and kind of transparent about church history in many aspects, you know, I think most of the people at the church, the brethren, maybe aren't. And we were told that by a lot of people, it's like, oh yeah, Rick would want to be able to talk about everything, but that's not how the rest of the brass feel about it. Look, KSL had stuff that nobody else had. They had the only interview with Mark Hoffman in 1980 when he had the Anthon transcript. And so those artifacts of the past were just crucial to be able to telling the story. But we didn't face we were able to use whatever we wanted, tell the story exactly the way that we wanted, and that's what we did.
Yeah, and they knew I was involved. I mean, it doesn't take long to know that I'm an ex-Mormon, and I've said a few things about it on, you can Google me, for goodness sakes, and it's out there. But they still, they kind of trusted us that we were going to tell a good story. They never interrupted us. They never involved us. They never asked to see a rough cut at all. Even when we supplied the footage, they said, we just want to know how you're using the footage we're giving you, KSL, which frankly, even in my last films, my MTV film, you know, places wanted to see the footage.
Yeah, that's that's a very normal thing, yeah.
Yeah, so honestly, I was actually kind of surprised. There was no pushback whatsoever.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I am grateful that you got the KSL footage, because I've said this all over the internet, Rod Decker singing the Utah song is something I will treasure forever.
You know, so, he wasn't KSL though. Rod Decker was KUTV.
So. KUTV. Well, the footage there, the Utah accents, it's just so perfect. I mean, if it weren't over such a dark topic, you know, we could do a root beer drinking game every time they say, you know, Utah accent words, brother and treasure and all of those things.
You mean treasure?
Treasure. Yeah, it was, I mean, some of them I probably don't even notice because I'm like, they said that fine. That's how people talk. But it was great. Okay, Cassie Woolley, who I think is tuning in from Australia, she asked about humorous elements. This is something, Jared, I don't know, did you see the change.org petition floating around about the...
Tyler and I saw it. We laughed pretty hard about they're wanting to be a spinoff buddy comedy, I guess about Shannon Flynn and Hoffman in the MR2, or maybe two Mormon nerds in an MR2. I don't know.
That's kind of amazing. Cassie says, did you do that on purpose? Because it is a dark, heavy topic where, you know, people were murdered, but there are these elements of style and sort of almost humor. And how did you incorporate that? Where did those come from?
Well, Jared's a very unfunny person. So he doesn't have much experience in comedy. True. So it was really difficult to try and do something with levity in this film.
Levity and mom jeans. You just like know how to put the mom jeans in all the things. It's
perfect. That's right. Ultimately for this, we tried, whoever was telling a story that we were bringing to life, we really tried to kind of take our tonal cues from them, right? And man, when Shannon Flynn was talking about like doing donuts in the desert and shooting Uzis, it was like the dorkiest Miami Vice meets the A-Team nerd living out their personal fantasy ever. And so we just, you know, yeah. Tyler and I approached it from that perspective. And
it was also like one of my early films, Sons of Perdition, we showed a rough cut to some documentary filmmakers, and Heidi Ewing, genius. She made Jesus Camp. She watched it and she said, you know, you just need a little bit of levity in it. You need a little bit of fun because it's so heartbreaking, and that film is heartbreaking. It's down and it's rough and it's hard and they're going through so much trouble, so we just put a few happy scenes in. And ever since then, I just love putting a little, even though it's a dark, you know, a dark subject. I mean, it's hard watching. I mean, you watch Night Stalker, like that film that was on Netflix, it's just so hard to watch murder and death and greed. So we intentionally and always wanted to put a little bit of fun in this film, which, you know, we did have a nice little fun 80s montage moment with machine guns. And that was a blast. It was a blast shooting it. It was a blast editing it. But what it does is it also shows the contrast between the fun of setting off bombs and machine guns and the pain that occurs later in episode 3. Those two contrasts of these things are dangerous as much as they are fun, I guess. So that was always intentional. From the get-go, we always knew we were going to have a little bit of lightheartedness in it.
So speaking of lightheartedness, and I actually don't even know how to say this because I don't know if it was done lightheartedly. It was something that actually stuck out in my mind that I've been thinking a lot about. But Chelsea Griffith Watts asked, what happened to the man who gave Hoffman a blessing? I'd love to hear his current take on what happened. That guy, he stole the Mormon show for all the Mormons. They can't stop talking about him.
There's a hashtag, give a blessing to Satan, that's trending, I think, right now. He's in the books. He's in the Salamander book. His last name is Christensen, no relation to Stephen. I don't know where he is. I'd love to find out if anyone knows where that dude is now. The beauty of it is he's so earnest in it. He's so like, you know, truth about it. He doesn't back down at all. The best thing Jared and I did was brought in two editors who had no understanding of Mormonism or Utah. And in fact, when they were coming on, I said, I'm going to send you the Salamander book and you should read it just to get up to speed. And both of them said, no, I don't want any prior knowledge of anything. We just want to know what you have and cull the story from there. And one day they put that in and showed us, and it just blew our minds. And for them, it just blew their minds. But again, the beauty of it is it's just like, you can't just put one crazy, stupid thing in and not follow it up. You know, we put it in, but in the third episode, it had an ending, you know, it had Shannon Flynn talking about it. So that dude is the original Napoleon Dynamite, I think. Right, Jared?
I think so.
Other than the Italian guy on your mission.
Right.
I hadn't heard that story. That's amazing. Okay. What about, several people have asked this, but what about the lack of women in the interview? It's mostly dude heavy. There's a lot of dudes.
We talked about it all the time. And yeah, I mean,
I would say there's a lack of women in the Mormon history world in the mid 80s would probably be the answer to that. We did interview one woman who unfortunately hit the cutting room floor, Jennifer Larson, who is this amazing document collector in upstate New York, who has spent her, you know, the last 20, 30 years trying to uncover all of Mark Hoffman's forgeries. We interviewed a number of individuals who we couldn't put in the film, mostly because we just decided to keep the inside. Anyone who was really involved in what was happening at the time outside of, you know, anyone who was outside of it or just like experts, we tried to just cut them out for the most part.
Yeah.
And unfortunately she hit the cutting room floor, but we would have loved more women in it. There just weren't, frankly.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know of any, I didn't know of her, but all the, you know, document dealers that I know are all men. So
yeah.
That makes sense to me. Let's talk about, you guys already covered this, but this is something that keeps coming up. Scott Barra asked, why didn't you put Oaks in it? Oaks and Hinckley are huge parts of the story. Some ex-Mormons and some people felt like you were doing that to protect the church. Did you feel like you were protecting a narrative by doing that?
No. It fell into the category of super boring to everyone else in the world. You know, it was, again, the momentum of it. And yeah, it was like, we talked about, oh man, you know, to me, it fell into the category of the Gerald and Sandra Tanner thing of them feeling that this was a forgery. It was kind of, I guess, tangent to the momentum of the investigation and the Hoffman story. And that, you know, again, falls into like people wanting like an expose about the church, right? Like people just seem disinterested. You know, we test screened this with a lot of people that knew nothing about Mormonism. So clear back in August, you know, we sent it out to like 30 or 40 different people, mostly in Los Angeles, you know, filmmakers and really, really smart writers that knew nothing about Mormonism. And, you know, we really had to establish on the first episode, like the tenets of it, so you could understand clearly the stakes and what a big disruption the Salamander letter was. And I mean, because that's crucial to kind of understanding the whole scope of the series. And anything that we had in that early cut that was like, ooh, let's have Oaks, you know, putting a spin on the Salamander, you know, with his Ensign article and everything. And it was super boring to people. They wanted to continue on the investigation. They wanted to know about Mark. They wanted to know, you know, what was happening. And that was like a story detour. So it's a fun theory.
The fact of the matter is all of these things that people wanted in it, we did too at some point. You know, the Pinnock story, Pinnock, that story is totally amazing. How he, you know, bought the McClellan collection and issued the check from First Interstate, essentially authorized it. But the fact of the matter is this stuff was in a cut. You know, the first, we didn't come out with a 2-hour, 40 minute movie. This was at one point a 7-hour movie with a lot of stuff in it. And we just had to pick and choose what was interesting. So it really just came down to telling the best, most concise story without getting in the weeds.
Yeah. And this has to play to the whole world, not just the Reddit community. You know what I mean? It's like if we, you know, if we made it just for that community, it would never have been in like the top 10 on Netflix, right? Like it would have been too inside baseball. It just, you know, it's like, so anyway, yeah.
Well, I think that's what, you know, the books are for. There are books and ways for people to take a deep dive. And I think that this is going to absolutely get people interested in this story in a way that they didn't before. What about Mark himself? Obviously, he isn't interviewed in the film. Do you guys want to talk about why and sort of, you know, where he is now?
You know, I've written Mark dozens of times in prison. I've been doing it for 4 years. He's never responded. And I mean, initially I just wrote him with the thought, well, maybe he'll write me back. And then he never did, but I just kept writing him. And what do you do when you write somebody who doesn't write you back? So essentially it just became we're growing tomatoes in the garden. They're coming up really nice. You know, it's like, I just would send him letters that I suspect being stuck in a jail cell in Gunnison were interesting. You know, I hear things about Mark in prison. I'd love to know more. We talked to a great prison guard. We actually interviewed him and couldn't fit him in because it was one of those, like, after Mark's incarceration, we decided not to cover it anymore. But he told some great stories about Mark in prison. I hear he's teaching math now. He's written some really great erotic poetry. Which I have some great Mark Hoffman erotic poetry.
Yeah, we should send it to you and you can put it on the Sunstone website or whatever.
That'll go over really well. You can tell he's using his Emily Dickinson spiritual gifts for something.
He is the best chess player in Gunnison prison, supposedly. But by and large, I don't know what he's doing. I'd love to talk to him. I have no idea. He hasn't talked to us. He won't talk to anyone.
And he was teammates with Lafferty, wasn't he? The other Mormon murderer for a while, for 20 years.
He was, yeah. He was roommates with the subject of Under the Banner of Heaven, the Krakauer book.
Which I hear is also making its debut on TV soon. So hopefully that'll happen. Scott Barrett asked, what conscious decisions did the directors make in navigating the treacherous line of covering Hoffman's story and his skill as a forger without making him a sort of anti-hero or coming off as too celebratory? Some people feel like, you know, we shouldn't be venerating or appreciating or, you know, calling a murderer good at what he's doing, being a good forger.
Don't make me answer that. Don't make me answer that. Let somebody else do it.
Yeah.
I don't want to make a hero out of him.
Such a good line.
He was fantastic.
Yeah, that's the truth. Yeah, I mean, it's tough. You can't ignore the craft. Like, he was the greatest forger of all time. And the stuff that he did, I mean, you know, and it's just the reality of the story, right? Like he... the stuff that he did, nobody had ever pulled off. I mean, he duped the biggest institutions in the world. You know, the FBI, Sotheby's, scholars, university professors, the LDS Church, like, oh, I mean, they were all victims of his deception, but they were, you know, fooled by the best that ever was. But that doesn't, you know, again, I don't feel like you have to pick one or the other, right? Again, that's like such black and white thinking, like, oh man, it's like, man, the guy was a dirtbag. You hear from his own mouth how callous he was with the murders and how heartless he was. He didn't care if the bomb killed like a neighborhood kid or a dog. He's an evil, evil, evil dude. At the same time, the forgeries were one of a kind. Like, nobody's ever been better. So I think you can look at both and go, yeah, he was just an evil, ruthless mofo. He, you know, crafted these incredible forgeries.
How do you make sense of him in the film where you have a clip of him saying something like, he's not that good of a forger, people just believe what they want to believe. Where do you feel like that fits in with his skill set? I've been thinking about that.
He said that, right, yeah.
He's a hell of a forger. He's remarkable. And having studied and replicated to the best of our abilities his forgery techniques, he's a genius. He's remarkable. And I know most of these people know these stories, but some of the things he did, the Oath of a Free Man is his Mona Lisa. It's remarkable. He studied the paper and knew where the paper and the printing press came from. This printing press of Stephen Day was the person who owned the printing press, first printing press that came to the United States. And he knew that this particular paper was the only paper used on this printing press at that time. So he searched all over to find it, and it had a certain weave, and it took him a long time to find it. He found it in the BYU library. He obviously, he cut the paper out of old books, the ends of it, and he used that. The techniques he used, the ink that he would do. So what he did, and we covered it in some of the film, with the kiln, the little fire, he found old letters of that time, old papers from that time, and he would burn them in this little kiln, and that would create ashes. And then he would use distilled water and beeswax, and gosh, I forget all the
gum arabic.
And he used that to create the ink, so that all of that was, if you were to test it, it would be from the era. And then he made the press, he made the printing, and then he filed it down, you know, just perfectly so that he could create this document. And I, you know, I could go on and on about some of the things he did, but some of the small things, like he put pieces of paper between bags of wheat in his basement because little bugs would eat through it. He had the right way to fold paper. He knew in the salamander letter, there was postage. The letter was mailed from one town to another. And he did extensive research to find out exactly how much that postage would cost. And that letter was only carried from that town to the other town between on a Thursday or a Monday. I don't know the exact dates, but he found that out.
The internet too.
It is now. Yeah, but he found all that stuff out and researched intently. And not only that, but he wrote letters. He wrote poems. You know, he wrote an Emily Dickinson poem, for goodness sakes, that fooled Emily Dickinson experts. I read a letter that he wrote to the guy who bought the Emily Dickinson letter. And he said that he spent a couple of hours reading Emily Dickinson poetry and found her muse, he said. And then he sat down and wrote it. And that's remarkable to do that and to find the handwriting style on the paper. According to him, he never practiced. He never, did a sample. You know, I don't even write a birthday card unless I try something first and then I throw it away and then put it on the birthday card. He just would pop it off. He'd almost get in this trance-like state to do these forgeries. He was the entire package, from paper to ink to currency to press to the discovery of it, the planting of it. The thing that Mark Hoffman did that was so genius is everybody loves a story. Everybody wants to buy something that was found in a garage sale. You know, Mark knew how to create these stories of where he found these documents. You know, he plant the Oath of a Freeman in the Argosy bookstore, buy a cheap copy of it, and then come back a few days later and put the real one in and profess that he got it. I mean, he was genius in every step he took, which is amazing that he got caught eventually by doing stupid shit like wearing a letterman's jacket and writing a $2 check.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I've seen, I'm trying to recall the other film. I saw another film about a forger a few years ago, and they sort of made the forger a hero. But do you feel like you did that in this film? Do you feel like you made a hero out of Mark Hoffman?
No, I don't think that we did. Yeah, I mean, I think he talked about his acts. Like, we were able to show him using his own words from the plea deal tapes that we were able to get. I think that you can be blown away by his skill level in creating the forgeries, but again, you can also see how evil and callous he was. So yeah, I mean, he's not my hero.
Modern storytelling has flawed protagonists. You know, he's a flawed protagonist. And I think there's a dark side in all of us that kind of wants to pull off a big crime like Mark did. And we don't, fortunately, but that's kind of why we like to watch other people do that.
And I just want a room in my house no one will ever go into. That's what I want. It's a miracle. Yeah.
The crazy thing about that is that was his childhood bedroom.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Yeah, we mentioned that in the film, but it's so brief. And the workshop that we created where he did his work and his bedroom was created to almost the exact specifications from photos that we had from the police investigation of it. I mean, I'll show you the photos of what we did and what it was. It's almost exact. It was fantastic.
That's great. That's so fun.
We had an amazing production designer in Utah, Jonas Sappington, and Sam Demke built all that and just did an amazing job.
Yeah, we did all kinds of stuff that were like when we parked the car, when it had Mark park the MR2, we parked it in the same spot. We didn't have to. It was, you know, an hour or two out of our way by the time you get the whole crew and the camera and everything there. But we felt it was important to be authentic. We used the methods that we could. We used actual pieces of Hoffman material when we recreated it. Actual forgeries, actual pieces of paper, actual pens, things like that. We tried to be as authentic as we could within the movie making magic realm.
That's what nerds like me appreciate. So I appreciate that. I want to ask one more question and then we can talk about projects that you guys are working on and what you see in the future. But let's talk about the impact of the film, especially on, you know, the people that were involved in it. And we can talk more with our panelists tomorrow about this. But what about the victims? Have you talked to their families about the film? What do you see as the impact of telling the story?
When we were, doing the interviews, most people had not spoken openly about this for 35 years. I mean, all the people that were close to Mark that dealt directly with him, whether it was Dory or Shannon or Brent Metcalf or Kurt Bench, it's like none of these people had really gone on record and had to walk us through these, you know, their life with Mark. And just the betrayal, the heartbreak. I mean, Al Rust, who you see in the film, was financially ruined for Mark. And there were countless moments when we were doing the interviews where just, the emotional gravity of everything, just the whole crew would be in a puddle of tears as people recounted the loss that they experienced from it. The stories of forgiveness, and we didn't have time for all of them, one of them made it into the film where Al Rust tells Hoffman's dad, hey, you're going to the prison to see Mark, tell him I forgive him. I need to move on with my life, kind of a thing. And it was like unbelievable. I mean, you know, and so, yeah, I mean, I was struck, I think it was cathartic for a lot of people to be able to talk about it, but it was also really, really, really heartbreaking.
As per the victims themselves, like Steve Christensen's family and Kathy Sheets' family, we haven't talked to them. I've heard secondhand that they did watch the film and it did upset them. We definitely pulled back on trying not to be too gruesome with some of the photos. And I've seen some photos and they're really, really awful. But we did need to show some just to show what Mark did. We had to do that. And I feel bad for them and I feel bad for the victims. And what we did try to do, though, and I actually told someone to pass that word on to them because they were concerned prior to it coming out. We try to show how wonderful of a man Steve Christensen was. And we try to show how wonderful Kathy Sheets was. And, you know, we do give more attention to Steve Christensen because he is an important cog in the story, unlike Kathy Sheets. Kathy Sheets was a bystander. And that's part of the awfulness of Mark Hoffman. He just killed somebody who had no involvement in it whatsoever. But we do show how wonderful Steve Christensen was and how much he was loved and how important he was. I could cut an entire episode on people talking about Steve and Christensen and how great he was. He was something else. And his father, Matt Christensen, the stories that people would tell us about those two, the stories that we didn't put in the series about Matt Christensen finding out about it, Matt Christensen giving suits to people. You probably read the Deseret News article about Matt Christensen paying for Mark Hoffman's suits to go on a mission.
His son's suits. Yeah.
His son's suits, rather. I mean, these are remarkable human beings. I think one thing that we tried to do with this story, and Dory called me today and she said, you were so nice to everybody. And the fact of the matter is we like all these people. You know, we Kurt Bench, Brent Ashworth, Brent Medcalf, all of these individuals, Dory, they're just amazing humans. Al Rust is one of the greatest men I'll ever meet in my life. You know that he was down about $500,000 when Mark disappeared, when that happened, about $500,000. He didn't, you know, a lot of people who bought Mark Hoffman forgeries just washed it off and said, sorry, you know, Kevit Emtor, you bought it. What am I going to do? Al Rust purchased back every single one of those documents that he gave to people, that he sold to people. In addition, he was out $185,000 that he gave to Mark for the McClellan collection. He was down about $500,000 and he paid it all back. It took him about 10 years, he said, but he paid everything back. He's a remarkable human. These are amazing people. And in this media landscape, I think we have, especially in kind of reality TV where people get vilified and you try to make somebody look like an idiot or you try to make someone look bad. I think it comes off on screen how much we really cared for these people and how really fantastic they were and how much they were hurt, which is part of the reason they may have been taken by Mark Hoffman in the first place. But we do hope that comes across.
Well, No, that's great. And Sunstone has, Steve Christensen did a Pillars of My Faith, I think, back in the 80s. So we're going to probably put his speech out because it's apparently very moving. I had never listened to it before. What do you see moving forward? Everyone wants more Mormon storytelling. Are you going to tell more Mormon stuff? Are you guys working on some stuff? You know, any hot tub parties with Kurt Bench in the future? What's happening?
Oh man. I mean, I would love to continue telling stories about weird Mormons. It'd be a dream to be able to do it. And there's clearly a market for it now. So we'll see. I mean, I'm currently in the middle of a big animated movie for Netflix called Thelma the Unicorn. It's a musical comedy. That's what I'm in the middle of working on right now.
You know, a lot of my films have centered on belief and why people believe certain things. And that's kind of been in my wheelhouse. I don't know if I'll stay with it or not. I'm uncertain. You know, my last film, I Want My MTV, was a blast. And making a documentary about music was a lot of fun. So I may go down that road. I haven't quite decided what I'm going to do next, to be honest with you.
Well, can we talk about what you had me work on? Is that public yet or no?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I've been, iHeart is launching a podcast series. I just say I'm not doing anything on belief again, but then you totally called me out on it, Lindsay. iHeart is releasing in June a podcast series called Cult Survivors. And it is a documentary style podcast that focuses on just one person who was in a cult and left a cult and how they overcame it. Lindsay is producing one of the episodes and it's a blast. It's really kind of interesting to not, you know, a lot of cult shows focus wide on the cult. We're just doing the individual themselves, what they went through and their personal journey. So I am doing that, I guess. Yes.
Well, yeah. And like I said, I've been able to see your storytelling up close and I really appreciated the opportunity. It's been fun to produce something. So both of you, I just want to thank you on behalf of the Sunstone community and Mormons everywhere. I know that maybe you didn't set out to tell a story of Mormons on a larger scale, but that's what you've done. And I think that the implications of that are going to have a big impact on our community in ways that I think are positive. I think telling these stories is important. Your work has absolutely shaped our community, both of you, and all the work that you've done. And this is just another addition to that. So on behalf of Mormons everywhere, I don't have permission to speak for them, but I'm going to thank you for this work. And I thank you for giving us the opportunity to have this conversation. Is there anything you want to leave people with or wish that they could know?
I thank you guys. You've been a very supportive group. You know, Lindsay, I've called you over the last few years. I think I told you in 2017 when I was going to make this, and you were kind of very helpful in many ways. But just the community in general and embracing this and supporting it. You know, this was a passion project for Jared and I. We didn't just take it to Netflix and all of a sudden they gave us money. It was 3 years of us trying to get this boulder pushed off the ground and a lot of people saying no. So we are ecstatic that where it is now. Number two, we'd love to see number one. Tell your friends, let's push it over the top.
I just said Taylor Swift needs a tweet about it and then you're golden.
I will call her. I will call
will
her.
You?
I will, but the breakup was hard. So I don't know if she wants to, I shouldn't text her.
No, that's probably maybe not. Jared, you handle that one.
But we're just ecstatic. We're so grateful that you guys are supporting it and friends are supporting it and people are supporting it. Thank you so much, everyone, for watching it.
Yeah, thanks, everybody.